We're ready to continue, actually, our cross-cultural chapels. Last Friday, we heard from the three groups that were on three-week cross-cultural seminars: Bolivia, Navajo Nation, and the local context. Today, we're hearing from the two groups that were on six-week summer cross-cultural learning adventures. First, we'll hear from the group that went to Spain, and then the group that was more broadly touring Europe, radical Europe, in fact. We're going to, we might have some slides at the very end after Friday announcements as well, a continuation of the slides from Spain. We'll see how that goes. So Spain first, if you'd come on up, and then radical Europe right after them, and then Friday announcements.
All right. Bienvenidos. Welcome to the cross-cultural chapel. This is this part of the Spain group. There's most of us here, but we were a group of 19 students, and we had two leaders, and we left May the 10th to go for this six-week trip, mostly into southern Spain was where we were located. And personally, I had a really great time, had many great experiences, a great group to travel with. And so here we're going to go through and talk about a couple of the different cities we visited and some different stories about experiences we had and what we saw and everything else. So here we begin.
Hey, everybody. I'm Capriel, and I'm a sophomore.
And I'm Cassidy, and I'm a junior.
And we both went on the summer cross-cultural to Spain this summer. We are here to talk about the first 3 weeks of the trip. And during that time, we got adjusted to the culture, stayed with host families, and went to language school, as well as participated in cultural activities. After traveling for about like 1.5 to 2 days, we finally arrived at our first destination, which was Cordoba. And here we did some exploring of the city, got used to the language, the time change, and the fact that culturally they didn't eat dinner until like 9 or 10 at night. So by that time we were all starving and tired. But we spent about 3 days here before we headed off to our next destination.
Our next destination was Cadiz, and this is where we spent most of our time. We spent 3 weeks there, and we lived with host families and attended language school. The host families was really a big thing for all of us. Most of us didn't speak Spanish, and it was very, like, we were all very anxious. But Capriel and I, we stayed with the same host family, and she actually worked with us really well, even though we couldn't understand. And it was a good experience overall, and we learned, like, once we started learning more Spanish in language school, she was actually really funny, and it ended up being a great experience.
Our main reason for being in Cadiz was the language school. We would go to the school Monday through Thursday, 9 to 2, and learn the Spanish language. It was a tedious 5 hours of them talking to us in Spanish and expecting us to understand what they were saying, but by them refusing to speak English to us, we started to grasp the concept of the language. The fact that our brains were tired and that we could see the beach from the windows of class made us not want to be in the classroom. But by the end of school, I think we were all proud of our accomplishments and were thankful we could better communicate with the people around us.
Even though we spent 4 days a week in school for the 3 weeks we were in Cadiz, we still found time to go to the beaches. And there was also a lot of cultural things we did. Some of the things we did was we got to do a surfing class for a couple hours, which was really fun. And then we also did a cooking class where we learned how to make several different Spanish dishes. And there was also flamenco dancing, which was kind of a hot mess, but I think we all enjoyed it overall.
Okay, I'm Erin.
And I'm Dan. I'm a senior biochemistry major.
And I'm a senior too, liberal arts major. And we're going to talk about our time in Sevilla and Portugal, which is where we all coincidentally chose our free travel.
Right, so after 3 weeks of staying in Cadiz, which was a really nice beach, small city, we went over to Sevilla, which was this really hot, humid, large city.
So hot. And from being in Cadiz, it was like you're coming from like where you could be on the beach every day, and it's like you were just getting comfortable and used to your host family, and then you're just like in this big city, it's like 105 degrees and there's no wind, and you're like, it was different.
Yeah, and we stayed in hostels now, so we had 9 guys in one room and 10 girls in another, so that was a huge different experience. But we did a lot of exploring while in Sevilla. We also went to the third largest cathedral in the world, and we went to the Fine Arts Museum and the Jewish Quarter and the Gypsy Market, where we bought food and made our own little picnic with the whole group. So it was very interesting seeing the different cultures kind of shape the form of Spain. You could definitely tell the influences between the Moorish people, the Jewish people, and the Catholics. And that was very evident in Sevilla. And then in the middle of this trip, we took a break and did our free travel, which was 4 days. And yeah, somehow every single person went to the same place in Portugal, which was a small town city in the southern coast of Portugal.
How do you say it? Carviera? Carviera?
Carviera. And so we had three different places, and we basically just relaxed the whole time. We had a pool with the guy's house. We went on kayak tours, and we just kind of explored the coast.
Yeah, the girl's house was better. So we, ours was more like a home-style feel, and we were, like, in this small little town, and we, like, would travel and do dinners together, and it felt like it was, like, a little piece of heaven, like, somewhere you go on, like, the best vacation ever, and we just stumbled upon it because we really didn't know what we were doing booking it, and it was just, like, it ended up working out so well for all of us.
But they didn't have a pool, so... But yeah, and you'll see in the pictures that the cliffs and the beaches were crazy. It wasn't just like a coastline. You'd have these huge cliffs on the side of the coast, and it was just an alcove. And you could go cliff jumping, cliff diving, and the water was just super clear, and it was the best. And then we went back to Sevilla, and it was hot again. But
yeah, the beaches in Portugal were something that I found was like one of the coolest things to think about. Because here in America, like when I think about going to the beach, like, I walk the beach, and you can just walk for miles and, like, go to the pier and stuff. But all the beaches that we went in Spain, pretty much, like, they were, like, segments of sand. It was, like, everybody was all clustered right together. You can't just keep walking and walking. And there's, like, they're, like, bordered by rocks. And in Portugal, it was just, like, the biggest cliffs you've ever seen. And people just, like, with caves in the cliffs and just, like, wandering through and jumping off of them, cliff jumping. The clearest water I've ever seen, the kayaks, like, we didn't need a tour guide, so we could just go off on our own.
Go to Portugal. It's the best.
Well, hello, everybody. My name is Mario, and during the last section of our trip, we spent some time zigzagging across the mountains part of southern Spain, across the white towns, the Pueblos Blancos, which are very small towns stuck on the tops of mountains, on the bottom of mountains, everywhere in the mountains. And they're called white towns because if you see them from the outside, they're entirely white. That's because it gets so hot that you paint those houses white. That way the sun bounces off and everything stays cool. And so these towns are incredibly small. And that's where we got to learn about Spain's population decline, because all the young people that are born to these towns are leaving them to go find jobs in either the bigger cities or abroad. And so these towns are slowly shrinking and slowly dying, sadly. And we got to go kayaking on one of those towns that had a reservoir that we could kayak across. We went to a vineyard and an olive oil factory to learn more about Spain's chief exports, which are wine and olive oil. And then we finally hit our very last city, which was it was Granada. And if you see Granada from a map, you see that the city stuck between two mountains. And that sort of is a good explanation of what the city was. So Granada was the very last city under Moorish control in Spain. And so it was the seat of all like the Islamic control in Spain. And you can kind of still see that today, as that was the city with the largest Arab population that we visited. And you could take a little micro tour into the Arab quarters of the city. On one side of the mountain is the Alhambra, which is the famous palace and fortress where the last Islamic ruler lived and enjoyed life, I guess, on top of that mountain, which is so big that it took us two entire visits to be able to accomplish seeing the entire thing. And so you have that imposed against the other side of the mountain, which is covered in caves and little tunnel systems, where the gypsy population were exiled from the city to live up in the mountains, again, away from what people would call the proper commoners. And so you have that Moorish influence lurking all over the Catholic city, which the gypsy population and the Jewish quarters kind of pushed aside. And so then inside the city, we got to experience the Corpus Christi festival, where the entire city participated in it. The streets were shut down, and everybody that was part of the city took part of it. The city officials, the church, school people. I think you might see some pictures of people dressed in these weird bobblehead costumes who would just come around and essentially bother you, but you were not entirely sure if this was part of the festival, so you wouldn't like fight back, and so it was just made you feel uncomfortable more often than not. After Granada, we took a trip on the very last couple of days to Capileira, which is essentially, if you keep driving across Spain up the mountain, you will reach that last town, because after which they realize we can't keep building on top of a mountain, let's just stop here and call it good. And so Capileira is the last of those white towns that you can see. It has 500 people. There's three buses that connect that city to civilization. And it doesn't even have a high school. There's just very little people. You immediately tell that you're out of place when you get there. And so it was a perfect place with remoteness and everything else to sort of reflect back on everything that we could do after spending so much time in bustling cities and beach towns. It was a nice change of pace to just sit up in the mountains and reflect. Some people took a horseback riding trip up the mountain. Some others decided to go on foot. However, we all took a trip one day to go take a picnic at a nearby dam. However, our plans were changed when the floodgates of heaven opened and a flood essentially came down on us and really put us to the test, both physically and mentally. Somebody in our group, who shall remain nameless, believed themselves to be stuck on top of a rock, which they thought was insurmountable, as other people just leisurely walked across it or climbed over it. So it really took a toll on us, I guess, mentally. And as we wrap this up, we saw that we had a 36-hour trip on the way back. And so we regathered whatever strength we had, and there was a essentially 24-hour overnight bus ride back to Madrid, where we would get there at 7 a.m., to take our flight, which left at 10 a.m., all the way to reach American soil, spend about 6 hours in JFK. And once you didn't see anybody else, you didn't want to see anybody else, we all left back, and now we're all happily congregated back here to report on that. And so if you want to learn more about anything else, anything we looked over, if you were wondering what's up with some of those pictures, you know, feel free to come talk to us, and we'll gladly tell you about that, because, you know, everybody loves to talk about their cross-cultural here. Thank you.
In 1972, Dr. Greta Mensensafy made an amazing discovery. Dr. Mensensafy was the first female chair of the history department at the University of Vienna, and she was the esteemed author of several books and articles on early modern European history, so think 14th, 15th, and 16th century Europe. While digging around in the archives, she found court records from an Anabaptist era in Austria, and these records documented that over 40% of the folks brought in to the Habsburg courts for questioning because of their Anabaptist beliefs, over 40% of these folks were women, and close to 50% of the people who were martyred were women. Dr. Mensensafy devoted the remaining 12 years of her life to translating and interpreting the records. The records also showed that in addition to significant women's involvement, the people who died for their Anabaptist beliefs were not a bunch of disgruntled peasants or wild-eyed ne'er-do-wells somehow outside the mainstream of early modern European society. They were bankers, bakers, weavers, printers, merchants, burghers, judges, magistrates, the household of a still famous artist, Bartolomeo Dill. These folks testified in court, and many died for their beliefs. Thanks to the work of Mensensafy and women's historians who followed her, we can now, for the first time, teach Anabaptist women's history in Europe on a tour. So this cross-cultural tour, Radical Europe, 16th and 21st Century Expressions of Anabaptist/Mennonite Identity, took us through Austria, Switzerland, and Germany, and it challenged students to think about their beliefs within the context of the Anabaptist movement of the 16th century and today's challenges facing Europe, namely environmental concerns and the refugee crisis. So Mennonite historians have been leading heritage tours to Europe since the post-World War II era. Going to Europe to discover one's Anabaptist history and thought is not new, but being able to fashion a six-week trip focusing on the history of women is, and this was the first ever trip to do that. It was my great pleasure to conceive and plan this tour and to lead this group of excellent students. Would I do it again with this group of students? I absolutely would, and I invite you to hear their stories.
Good morning. My name is Julie Burkhart.
And I'm Becca.
We're going to do some stats that we counted throughout the 6 weeks we were in Europe. Number of times we asked where Becca was, 100.
How many cups of coffee we drank, 405.
How much chocolate we bought, way too much to count.
The total number of photos we took, 28,828.
Longest escalator ride, 1 minute and 5 seconds.
Number of times we talked about math, 35.
Number of Lamborghinis we saw, 7.
Number of times Hannah Marston Peter Pants because she laughed so hard, 10 times.
Number of times Madison got hurt, 18.
And the number of walking tours we did, 27.
Number of churches and museums we visited, a couple hundred or so.
And the number of schnitzels we ate was 56.
All right, I'm Tim Martin. If you know me, you can probably guess why we talked about math that much beyond that. So while we were in Switzerland, we visited Trotzewald Castle in the Emmental region. And aside from its use as a defensive structure to control the surrounding area, the castle was also used as a prison for Anabaptist prisoners. And this one actually had some personal connections because one of my own ancestors was imprisoned there for about 15 years before fleeing across the Atlantic to Pennsylvania in 1732. Holding a personal connection to the site made it more than just a next castle we visited, as we visited several of those, but, well, yeah, it gave a little more to the history of things. However, just because history can get really interesting and exciting doesn't mean that we aren't college-age hooligans who immediately decide to take photos inside of the cells. So one of those is actually going to come up there, and we may or may not have titled that 10th Generation Delinquent.
I am Madeline Payne, a junior math education major here at EMU. And 6 weeks in Europe doesn't sound like very long, but it was long enough for me to come back changed. And specifically, I want to talk about one change that happened. My parents didn't grow up as Anabaptists, but joined an Anabaptist congregation when I was young. My father felt called to ministry and became a pastor in the Church of the Brethren. Growing up, I watched my parents make the conscious decision to be and to hold up Anabaptist principles. Prior to the trip, I would have merely called myself a Christian with a personal, faith-based relationship with Christ. If asked, I would explain that I'm a member of the Church of the Brethren, an Anabaptist denomination. The term Anabaptist was merely a larger category for me to fit my denomination within. Unlike some of my peers on the trip, I didn't have rich Anabaptist history in my genealogy. One evening, about halfway through the trip, sitting on top of a mountain in Switzerland at a hotel called Bienenberg, I was talking to my parents on the phone and reflecting with them about the day that I had had. We had went up into the Swiss mountains to a cave where Anabaptists used to go to pray and to sing and to worship and to support each other. The mouth of the cave was covered with a waterfall, and the waterfall muffled the sounds of their voices so they could sing without worry. While talking to my parents, I realized that the principles that I stand for today are the same ones that the early Anabaptists were standing for. This realization challenged me. Would I be willing to face death because of my faith? Would I be brave enough to buck culture for the sake of truth? Now, after the trip,
I truly identify as an Anabaptist. Ask me about my faith, and I'll give you the same spiel, but I will put a big emphasis on the fact that I am an Anabaptist. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Madison Street, a junior bio major. As y'all can guess by now, a lot of our trip was centered around religion, and I was actually the only Lutheran on the trip. So we actually got to go to the Wittenberg Church, where Luther posted his 95 Theses, and I remember sitting in the front pew, right in front of his grave, actually, and thinking to myself, like, it actually kind of made me a little emotional how, like, impactful this was on my life. If this man hadn't posted his thoughts and went against what everyone else told him, I wouldn't be who I am today. So that was a pretty cool moment for me. And a lot of our group had the same types of moments in different places, but it was definitely a life-changing experience, to say the least.
Hi, I'm Hannah Marston. I'm a junior early education major. And besides peeing my pants all over Europe, we did do some other things. Previously, before I went on the trip, I had went to EMU. I took a semester off and went to LFCC. And so my cross-cultural was kind of like my last hurrah with EMU. I didn't see myself coming back, and I had a hard emotional battle with EMU. And going on this cross-cultural, I brought back so much more than just churches and museums and souvenirs. I brought back friends and a great respect for the school that we go to. Going on this trip kind of gave me an idea of why I should stay at EMU, and all of the people sitting here all have stories from what we experienced over in Europe, whether it be religion, friendship, or just same with her schnitzel. But to me, these places that we went and stopped at and took pictures at will always mean more to me than just a church that we saw. It will be places where I built friendships and where I decided that EMU was my home. And so one of my favorite places that we went to was a little town called Hallstatt. It was in Austria. This town is so small, and it is built in the mountains of the Swiss Alps, or the Austrian Alps. I can't talk today. And you have to take a boat to get there. They employ one fisherman all year because the town is so tiny, and if you have more than one, they will deplete the entire lake. But the best part about Hallstatt is that when you go there, it's picturesque. It's the epitome of what a Disney fairy tale village would look like. And yet you almost feel like it's not real. And that was the exact place that I realized that EMU was going to be my home, and that it was my choice and my decision to turn my life around the way that I wanted it to be. And with the help of everybody sitting here, I can say that I'm happy to be at EMU. So, yeah.